Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
Has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two.
Gilmore on a
big step.
Oh,
brother.
Lead Toledo Artis. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead.
Hello and welcome back to Over and Back, Classic NBA Podcast at HarvardParoxysm.com. I am Jason Mann, and Rich couldn't make it this time, but we are going to continue our WrestleMania series with our special guest, one of our favorite frequent guests on the program, Curtis Harris of ProHoopsHistory.com. Curtis, welcome back to the show, sir.
Hey, good to be with you, Jason.
And so we're going to kind of tackle a lot of things. We're going to kind of tackle the Celtics dynasty as a whole and looking at kind of breaking down some of the things that made them an overall success. You know, Bill Russell obviously being a major part of that, you know, the biggest factor in that, clearly, I would say. Looking at some of the other guys he played with, how they kind of fit together, how the Celtics dynasty sort of compares to some of the other short and long-term dynasties in NBA history, how the Celtics defense really fueled that dynasty, and some things of interest that we think will be kind of illuminate, give more depth on the on Russell and the Celtics beyond just the 11 championships in 13 seasons. So you wrote a piece recently at Sporting News looking at Russell and the Celtics' performance in Game 7s. And Russell was famously 10-0 in Game 7s. And a lot of those came, were from a very narrow margin and definitely could have gone a different way. We kind of got into, talked about that a little bit with Yago Kolas on our last show, looking at the Wilt Russell dynasty. But what were kind of the main points of your article? What do you think of kind of the idea that the Celtics dynasty, obviously incredibly impressive, and even if a couple of these had turned a different way, would still be impressive, but it is sort of a narrow margin in some respects.
Yeah, the point I wanted to make with that article wasn't that, like, the Celtics weren't great, because they clearly are great. 11 titles in 13 years kind of speaks for itself in that front. But having said that, I don't think it said enough about them, though, or, like, enough about the NBA of that period. Because if you just look from 57 to 69, you see, like, you know, Celtics. You think that's all the NBA was. So trying to look at, like, you know, those really close Game 7s that they survived, I thought would help kind of shed some light just on how, like, hard the Celtics had to work to get all those titles. Like, they didn't just push over everybody, but also showing on the flip side that those other teams were really good. And sometimes the difference between them being champions or Boston being champions was a last second shot, a last second steal, 1, 2, 3, 4 points, which is not a lot of difference. You know, that's one or two shots over the course of the game. So it's not trying to detract from the Celtics or add to anybody else. I think it's just trying to, like, level out what really happened in that period as best as I can do in one article.
Yeah, and of course the Celtics are battling against some great teams and some great players. Early on, the rivalry with the St. Louis Hawks and Bob Pettit, dealing with Dolph Schayes and the Syracuse Nationals, and then Wilt comes into the league with the Warriors and the 76ers, and finally the Lakers toward the end of his career. And obviously I think it was 7 finals that the Celtics and Lakers faced in, and with the Celtics winning each time, but you know, a couple of those just being incredibly close. I think three of them actually came down to like two or three points in, you know, of the final margin. I mean, just really, really close.
Yeah, like 1962, like this, that's the most famous one. Well, maybe the second most famous one. That's the one where Frank Selby like missed the last second shot in regulation. So if he had made that shot, LA would have beat Boston and won the title. Then in, I think it was 66. This is the one I did not include in the article because like seven's a nice number, like seven games, seven escapes. But if I had done like an eighth one, it'd have been 66 when LA like made like a, I think it was something like an 8-point comeback in the final minute of the game.
Right.
It was really furious. They really didn't have enough time to make the full comeback, but that was that one. They lost by 2 points. And then, of course, in 69, that was the one with Wilt's knee problem and Coach Van Bredekhoff and him getting into their little feud. And Boston once again surviving by 2 points. So, LA, like Elgin Baylor and Jerry West look a lot different if they were like, you know, three-time NBA champions instead of, you know, perennial losers to the Celtics.
Yeah, absolutely. And it came very, very close to that. And Wilt is the same way. I mean, the 68, the 69 finals, as you mentioned, the 68 division finals, where the 76ers were, you know, were probably the stronger team in there, but the Celtics were able to come out of it, or coming down from a 3-1 hole. 65 and 62 as well, you know, extremely close. 65 very famous for, you know, Havlicek stealing the ball, batting it toward Sam Jones at the end of there. But I mean, if you look at Russell's performance in these games, I'll just kind of go through the stats a little bit. Game 7 of the 57 finals against the Hawks, he has 19 points, 32 rebounds. Game 7 in against the Nationals in 59, division finals, 18 points, 32 rebounds. That was kind of the last stand for Dolph Schayes and the Nationals being, you know, an elite team before the move to Philly a few years later. Then in 62 in the division finals, Russell had 19 points and 22 rebounds. 62 finals, Russell had 30 points and 40 rebounds, which is pretty incredible.
That one's absurd.
Yes. I think that is that the finals record for rebounds in a game?
Yeah. 40 is definitely the record for rebounds in a finals game.
Okay. The 65 Eastern Division finals, 15 points, 29 rebounds. In the 66 finals, 25 points. I'm not sure if we have rebounds for that, at least not on the official record. In 68 Eastern Division Finals, this is Russell's second to last season, 12 points, 26 rebounds, 5 assists. The scoring was obviously never quite his strong suit, but was, you know, starting to go down his last couple seasons. And in the 69 Finals, 6 points, 21 rebounds, 6 assists. So still getting those boards and still doing enough to make it work. And I obviously the Celtics were a you know, Russell was the important part of that, the most important part of that machine. But they really were just incredibly well put together, particularly defensively. And what do you think the keys were to kind of as far as the pieces kind of complementing each other, and for them to kind of be able to sustain that success over that length of a period of time?
Like the defensive aspects, it's like Russell was absolutely like the key on the defensive side. But they did have some other players who were, you know, fantastic defenders. Like in the early years, Jim Loskatov, good defender, but even better enforcer. So he would like kind of add the muscle to kind of rough people up. Then they added Satch Sanders, who was absolutely a really great defensive player. If they had like all defensive teams back then, he probably would have been on the first and second team every single year for his whole career until the early 70s. And then Sam Jones, obviously known for his offense, but he was a really good defensive player. John Havlicek, another good defensive player. So you can see how like these they have like these rangy at small forward and shooting guard, but also at power forward they'll usually get like a kind of a burly guy. And those guys really had room to flourish because Russell was able to, you know, cover up for so many mistakes. So say if Hondo or Sam Jones like goes for the steal in the passing lane and they miss it, you know, they have margin for error because Russell's going to be behind them cleaning up the mess by blocking a shot or intimidating the opponent who gets to the basket.
Yeah.
So, you know, good defenders all around on the team for the most part. But with Russell's ability just to clean up the mistakes, it really just amped up their ability to play kind of frenetic, hectic defense that would throw the opposing offense off balance. And that's really where their whole game started from, was Russell controlling the boards and the glass. And then on the offensive end, it all just dovetailed off of that.
Yeah, and of course Russell being really the first in the NBA, or really probably at all levels, to be able to use the block shot as a weapon the way that he did, with the with before that sort of the conventional wisdom in basketball of being you don't leave your feet on defense or you can get blown by, but you know, him having the ability to sort of understand the power of it and experiment with it and experiment with jumping and, you know, understanding his movements and his opponent's movements, and of course having just the incredible physical ability to be able to jump that high and to be able and having that timing and that skill, that all just worked out for him to be that incredible defender. And then Coach Red Auerbach understanding how Russell could really fit in to that, and you know, and to, you know, power what had sort of been a, you know, a pretty good team through the mid-50s, but always kind of a team that, you know, would score a lot of high point totals, but, you know, never really had much ability to stop people, and, you know, would generally lose a lot of times to Syracuse in, you yep. know, in the playoffs. So one thing that stands out to me is just how much better the Celtics were defensively compared to the rest of the league. They led the NBA in defensive rating 12 of 13 seasons. The only in Russell's career, the only season they did not was the was 67, the year that the 76ers were historically great 68 win team, which was the record at the time. They on average had a 7.3 better defensive rating than the league average. So teams weren't even like close to them, other than the last couple seasons with the 76ers. It really was not a you know, a close margin. If you look at the Celtics averaged a defensive rating of 86.4 during Russell's tenure, and the second place finisher was an average of about 4.2 worse than the Celtics in defensive rating. Some of the peak years, they were 6.5, excuse me, better than the Syracuse Nationals in 62, 7.6 better than the Hawks in 65, and generally, you know, 4 or above most of those seasons. And if you compare that to the last 5 years, the Warriors were only 0.6 better than the Spurs. The Pacers were 1.2 better than the Bulls in 2014. In 2013, the Pacers were 0.5 better than the Grizzlies. And in 2012, the Celtics were 0.1 better than the Bulls. And in 2011, the Celtics were tied with the Bulls. So these are, you know, very tight margins compared to you know, what the Celtics were averaging, much less what they were at their best. So You would maybe expect with more teams the distribution to be a little bit tighter, but I still think just the level in which the Celtics were ahead of everybody else in defense really, I think, does stand out when you look at it that way.
Again, you know, it speaks to mostly Russell's ability. Well, I don't say mostly, but it speaks a lot to Russell's ability. Just how groundbreaking he was, how he played defense. Because you know, we forget, like, today's shot blocking is such an accepted part of the game, and how you block the shots. Like, you know, we need the rim protector, and like, you jump up and swat the shot. Like, today that's pretty obvious. But, you know, in 1956 and 57, when he first came to the NBA, you know, opponents really didn't have to account for that. Like, they had probably played their whole basketball careers, you know, high school, college, pro to that point, without having anybody who could jump up and, like, slap their shot back at them like that. So, you know, probably took the offenses, you know, we see, like, the defensive numbers. Like, it took them, like, probably almost a decade to kind of really adjust to what Russell was doing. And then, of course, you also had Will Chamberlain doing a similar thing, not to the degree that Russell was, but still doing a similar thing. Then Nate Thurman coming along, too. So when you started getting these other shot blockers, I think it kind of symbolizes or shows that the shot blocker was expanding in the NBA, but also people's reactions to him were also starting to grow. Like, they kind of, that environment was out there, basically. They had started to evolve to it. So I think that's why you saw the Celtics kind of come back to the pack toward the end of their run, which is a factor of age, but also think it's a factor of the teams kind of learning how to play Russell a little bit better.
Yeah.
And then being able to adjust to that. But overall, like, it just shows how revolutionary he was and how he controlled the defense and how good the Celtics were all around with, you know, Hondo and Sam Jones, I mentioned, but also forgot Casey Jones, too, another great defender.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
To help out with that. So it wasn't just Russell, but he was clearly like the linchpin of all that.
Yeah, and, you know, we kind of have the, obviously, the modern understanding of what value a rim protector can have, you know, especially in the league today. And I think that, you know, Russell absolutely fits that to a T, not just with his ability to jump and block shots, but his ability to rotate and ability to cover mistakes, as you were talking about. The Celtics famously had what they called a hay bill defense, where, you know, basically if the guy got beat, you know, he would yell "Hey Bill" and have Bill cover the mistake. That is, you know, just a remarkable difference, I think, and really does give does stand out. Now, the Celtics, not particularly a strong offense. And, you know, this is during a time in which the league in general was getting better at offense. The shooting percentages were going way up, partly because of the popularity of the jump shot and just the ability for more players to do it and to do it well. And, you know, maybe a smarter understanding of shot taking and just scoring was going crazy, but a lot of that, of course, was pace related as opposed to better shooting, but it still was a part of it. So all this defense is coming in within the context of a league that is exploding offensively. But the Celtics, although obviously they did score many more points as things changed, and they did sort of lead the drive in the increase in pace with you know, there with Russell being able to, his defense sort of feeding into the fast break and his passing as well, kind of feeding into more, you know, transition opportunities and you know, kind of leading the league in that trend. Obviously, you know, things that are successful are often copied. But they did not rate well offensively. They were last in the league for three seasons during that time, and the only time they were in the top half in offensive rating was once in 64. So it wasn't offense that was feeling it, but again, the defense was so much tremendously better than the rest of the league that the lack of offense wasn't important.
Well, I would kind of look at it as their defense, like, this is kind of like a backwards way how they did it, but like, their defense created more possessions for them on their offense.
Sure.
So they could, like, obviously they had talented offensive players, but, you know, relative to the other teams in the league, they didn't have virtuosos like Elgin Baylor or Oscar Robertson who could, you know, manufacture offense on a dime.
Yeah.
But with their defensive ability, I think they gave them like the confidence that, all right, you know, yes, like we can run out, take more shots than the other team and be confident that on the defensive side, we'll stop them from scoring and still be able to get back and have another shot, another crack at scoring on offense. Mm-hmm. So like the first like 8 or 9 years of their dynasty, like 57 through 65 or so, they were like the top team in pace in the NBA. So you're talking about like the fastest paced era we can calculate, but the Celtics were the fastest paced team in the fastest paced era. And that was all driven by their defensive effort. And looking at it, like, I went through and found, like, their leading scorers from 57 through 69. And Bill Sharman led them for three seasons. Tom Heinsohn led them for three seasons. Sam Jones led them for 5 years. And John Havlicek for 2 years. So looking at it over the course of 13 years, they had 5 different leading scorers on the team.
Yeah.
Which is really odd for, like, a dynasty of that way. And then also the – we talk about the fast pace they had, but the top points per game they had on the team from an individual was Sam Jones in 1965 with 25.9 points per game.
Yeah.
So you're talking about the team with the fastest paced offense or the fastest pace in the fastest paced era, but their top scorer for the whole 13 years was Sam Jones with 26 points. And every other year, the guys are floating like at 21 or 22 points per game leading the team. So it was really like a really spread out offense. No one guy was dominating the ball. They would always have like 5, 6, or 7 players in double figures on the squad. So it's a really different mold in how we've come accustomed to like a team winning a championship. Because for the most part, these last 25 years especially, like the team who's won the championship has had a guy scoring, you know, 28, 29, 30 points a game. But the Celtics were a complete opposite of that, even when they were playing in the fastest paced era in basketball history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it really does seem very similar to kind of what the Spurs have done for the last 16, 17 years.
Yeah. Them and the Pistons, I guess, are like the exceptions to the, like the, and the Celtics that 1 year. But yeah, for the most part, it's like the 30 point score leading a team to a title.
Yeah. As far as like, there've been a few instances of, you know, a success in a year or two here, but as far as, continued success, over a long period of time. It really does seem like the Spurs culture and philosophy of the past, 16, 17 years is the most similar thing that, that I can think of in NBA history in terms of, just not necessarily being dominant by one player, at least on offense. I mean, Duncan in his peak years, clearly did have that, but it's been a long time since he's really been, a low to mid 20 scorer. And, they've always kind of had the share the burden. No one's really ever had, an immensely high usage rate there that I can think of, other than Duncan in a few of the peak years, probably. And also, looking for complimentary players without egos, as Popovich always called it, like, guys who are over themselves. And I really do think there are some really good parallels kind of between the two cultures and obviously the success that that both teams have had.
Yep.
And yeah, I guess Rich ran, by the way, Rich has run, all these great stats are from Rich, who we, of course we know is great at putting together numbers. But if we're kind of comparing the Celtics, their winning percentage and their SRS compared to some of the other short-term and long-term dynasties in NBA history, tough to conclude much from this, but it's just kind of fun to kind of compare them. If you compare them to the 49-54 Lakers, the Lakers had a 68% winning percentage and a 5.56 SRS, so both are a little bit worse than the Celtics. The 80-91 Lakers had a 72% winning percentage and 5.64 SRS. And of course, if you compare the Celtics, of course, won 11 championships in 13 years, made 12 finals, and they won 26 series during that time. The there were a lot fewer teams, so there were a lot fewer playoff series during that period. The Lakers won 5 rings in 12 seasons, made 9 finals, and won 32 series. The Bird Celtics of 81-87 actually won. They won 75% of their games and had a 6.61 SRS, which is pretty strong. 3 titles in there as well. The 91-98 Bulls had a 74% winning percentage and a 7.72 SRS, which is the strongest of any of these teams. Winning, of course, 6 rings in 8 seasons, making 6 finals, and winning 26 series, which I thought was kind of interesting that they won the same number of series as the Celtics did. And then the 2000 to 2004 Lakers, who won 3 titles in 4 seasons, had 70% winning percentage, almost the same as the Celtics, and had a 5.27 SRS, which is the lowest of any of these. The Spurs from 99 to 2000 through 2014, which was their last finals win and appearance, 71%, 6.54 SRS, 5 rings in 16 seasons, made 6 finals and won 33 series. And then the 2011 through 2014 Heat, 72% winning percentage, a 5.92 SRS, and then 2 rings, 4 finals appearances. And win percentage-wise, the Celtics are only better than the Mike and Lakers. The winning percentage generally has kind of gone up as those dynasties have gone through. And SRS-wise, only the Bird Celtics, Bulls, and Spurs rate better. So they're sort of in the middle. But if you're looking, kind of comparing, I think the better apples to apples comparison, or the closest that you can possibly come, and there's so many differences, I think probably the Magic Johnson Lakers, the Jordan Bulls, and the Duncan Spurs are kind of the most comparable in terms of length of their run and accomplishments over a long period of time.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, he ran through it. Like the Spurs, Celtics, 80s version, and the 80s Lakers, man, I guess 90s Bulls, how could I throw them into? Yeah, sure. Those are like the only teams that can compare in terms of length of time that they had and how successful they were over that period. So
sure. Yeah. It's such a different NBA, obviously, no one's come close to 11 in 13, obviously under different conditions than modern teams with more playoff rounds and more teams have to deal with, but not meant to take away from anybody or just sort of give like an overall context of the accomplishments, or just kind of give some interesting totals. So you had some Bill Russell specific stats that you that you wanted to share. What were some of those?
Well, let's see. Let me get my paper out.
Sure.
All right. So like Bill Russell, and also this is kind of like player specific. So Russell, I also got a couple more on some other players, but with Russell, people often kind of. This, I'm sure, this is a point Yago has made. I hadn't listened to your podcast with him yet. Unfortunate admission. I'll get to it soon. But the thing with Russell is, like, you know, people naturally look at how great his defense was and then assume that he wasn't a good offensive player. And I think the mistake there comes when they look at his field goal percentage. And they're like, oh, he shot, like, 44% for his career, which obviously is not great for a center these days, but... when he retired in 1969, his career field goal percentage of 44%, that was 39th all time. And there was only three players that had shot over 50% for their careers to that point. So given the context of his era, like his shooting percentage wasn't great, but it also wasn't bad. It was just kind of like a little bit above average for what was of the period. But even more importantly than that, wasn't necessarily like his scoring, although he could do big scoring games, like those 30 points in game sevens that he would have. But his passing, I think, is really what's gone overlooked for so many years, besides the people who like really take time to look at it. But like just a kind of general look at Russell, it's like he blocked the shots, he got the rebounds, and then other guys did the scoring. But it's not acknowledged enough that he was the one that was often passing and actually controlling the offense, especially after Bob Cousy retired. For the Celtics. And so his assist per game total was 4.3 for his career. That is still second all time for centers, and only Will Chamberlain's ahead of him with 4.5. So this is a guy who was really more than just the block shot, the guy who blocked the shots, who could get the rebounds. He was really a really savvy, knowledgeable, competent offensive player, more than competent. Like he was a great passer. Didn't do like behind the back stuff, but he could hit the cutters. He could push it on the break. Like he just made the timely right pass, a good bounce pass to get a guy. Like you don't have to do the behind the back stuff to make a good pass. And Russell was just fantastic at finding the open teammates on offense. Mm-hmm. So that's with him. And then there's other stats I found, my Sam Jones stats. I love Sam Jones. And this is a dude who just unfortunately gets like, I use the word overlook a lot, but he gets overlooked too. Because like the shooting guards from the 60s, it's like Jerry West, he's the paragon of it. And then also people remember Oscar Robertson, not a shooting guard, but point guard, but he's the other guard from the 60s. But Sam Jones was a dude who could have done, I think, more in his career, but his personality just dictated that he didn't like stepping up and being the man all the time. Bill Russell admitted as much. I remember some books I've read on it. And Russell was quoted as saying stuff like, you know, he would come up to Sam Jones and tell him, like, you know, hey, Sam, like, you can take more of a load on offense. Like, you don't have to score just 22 points a game every year. But Sam Jones would, like, just shirk back and be like, no, I don't want that. I just want to flow within the offense. I don't want to try to score 30 points a game. He was comfortable scoring 20 points a game. But then during playoff time, for whatever reason, when it got to the game six or the game seven, he would just escalate his scoring. Like, let's see what I got here. So from 1962 to 1965, regular season, Sam Jones averaged 21 points. In the playoffs, he then averaged 24 points. And then in elimination games, he averaged 26 points. So when the pressure's getting up, he decides, like, all right, now it's time for me to step in and actually do my thing and score the points that my team needs. And then this is 1966 through 69. He's still at 21 points in the regular season, 22 points in the postseason, and then 23 points in elimination games. So,
and he's in his mid-30s at this point.
Yeah, he's like 34. That's another thing. Like, he didn't get started till he was older. Like, I think his rookie year, he was 25 or 26 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And then he didn't become a starter until, like, his fourth year. So I think he was maybe pushed up to him. Maybe he started at 24. So I think he became a starter at age, like, 28 or 29 when Bill Sharman retired. So this is a guy that got a late start in his career, but he was excellent throughout his whole career after he got the starting job. And his final game was that Game 7 in 1969. Like, that was Russell's final game, but that was also Jones's final game. And he scored 24 points, shot 10 for 16 from the field, and made all four of his foul shots. So he's like 35, 36 years old at that point. He's, you know, shooting 10 for 16, getting 24 points in a Game 7. So that was a guy that was absolutely clutch, deserves a lot of credit for the Celtics getting those championships. Russell's got the 11 rings, but Sam Jones has got 10 of them, too. So yeah, he's the only other dude with double-digit ring counts.
Right. Yeah, I think that I wonder if he actually had stood up and tried to, like, do more on offense, if that would have been a little bit disruptive for what the Celtics are doing. Because, it seemed like they were such, it was so egalitarian there in terms of, offensive role, that if one guy had tried to do more, would that have been a disruptive effect on the whole team? It's an interesting question.
Yeah, I think it's a good thought, like, especially during a regular season. I think come playoff time, as we saw, like, the guys would kind of defer to Sam because, like, sure. I mentioned earlier how they didn't have, like, an offensive, savant, really, on offense. But Sam Jones really, in the playoff time, he decided to become the savant. Like, he had, he had 51 points in a elimination game to get rid of the Knicks in 1967, scored 51 points against them.
Mm-hmm.
Had, like, 37 points to save Boston from getting eliminated another year. Had, like, 47 against the Royals one year against Oscar Robertson. I think Oscar had, like, 51 in that game. So Sam, like, he could, clearly, I think he could have scored, like, 28, 30 points, especially in that era, like, the amount of shots he could have got his hands on. But I think it's a very good point that he might have realized that, maybe I could get 25 to 30 points a game without a problem, but maybe that would cause a problem for the team as a whole, because then it kind of throws the offense out of whack. And if guys don't feel like everybody's getting the appropriate amount of touches, we're not the egalitarian team with six or seven players in double figures, maybe just five players in double figures, maybe that throws off their defensive effort. And then Russell's a great defender, but he can't, he can't clean up every mistake. So if guys aren't giving their all on defense, maybe that throws that off. And if the defense goes, the whole thing is going. Because that was their bread and butter, was the defense.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Sam Jones, like, on a per minute basis was, just, a notch below what Oscar and West were doing production wise. It was just that, he played fewer minutes, even later in his career. I don't think he ever quite had the full load regularly that, the 40 minutes a game. He was more of a low 30 minute a game type player. And obviously, as you mentioned, he was on the bench for the first year of his career behind Bill Sharman. That was another special thing that the Celtics did. They were able to kind of the players were willing to, as they got older, they were willing to mentor the younger players and kind of get them ready to kind of fill their role. I mean, that happened with Sharman and Sam Jones. It happened with Frank Ramsey and John Havlicek. It happened in a number of circumstances. Arnie Risen when Russell came in. Yeah.
Yep.
So, I mean, that really, was another special thing that kind of put the Celtics apart from not just any team in that era, but almost any team in history. I mean, that's a pretty strong culture to be able to, to not have the egos get in the way on those things.
Yeah. Well, it worked on a number of fronts. Like we mentioned, like the older guys mentoring the younger players into like the positions that they should assume. But a lot of those guys were like, castaways and retreads too. So like a lot of them, Boston was like the team that picked him up from like a no-name college or from the scrap heap in the NBA. And they kind of felt like a, I won't say like too strong, because like it is sports, it is a business still, but like as far as you can in that atmosphere, they would feel like a fierce loyalty to themselves, to their teammates, to the franchise. Look at guys like Larry Siegfried or Don Nelson in the later years. Like these are guys that no other franchise really took a chance on, or they had taken a chance, like, you know, say like, you know, you're not good enough, so we're cutting you. And like Don Nelson, that's a really great one, where he played for the Lakers, I think, for maybe a season or two, definitely one season, but maybe two of them. And they cut him, and like in, I think, 64 or 65. And then he goes to the Celtics, and he plays for the Celtics through like 1976. And he hits huge shots for the Celtics. And like he was like the next sixth man off the bench. Like after Havlicek got in the starting lineup, Don Nelson was the next guy who would take the role of sixth man and just come in and pump in points for him. And the old veterans too, like the guys who were desperate for a ring, like they would come in and just be like just thankful that they had a chance to play for a good team. Like Andy Phillip in the very first title year, he was a great point guard from the 50s, but got his ring with the Celtics. Mentioned Arnie Risen, he already had a ring, but got his second one with the Celtics. Carl Braun, great shooting guard with the Knicks in the 50s and 60s. He got a ring with the Celtics finally because the Knicks sucked for the late 50s, unfortunately for him. Another dude, Clyde LaVellant, meanest elbows in the world, and he just passed away last week. But he's another guy who played for the Celtics for a couple of years, had been around the NBA, got himself a couple of championship rings in his final couple of years. So they had a way of balancing like the top draft picks like Russell and Havlicek with finding lesser-known college players like Sam Jones, for example, or Casey Jones as well, but also finding the elder statesmen like Clyde LaVellant and Carl Braun, and then also getting the guys like Don Nelson off the scrap heap. So you had a lot of guys who had a lot of chips on their shoulders and would be willing to play that kind of hard-nosed defensive style because they were there trying to prove that they belonged in the NBA, I think.
Yeah, and that reminds me, that's another kind of comparison to the Spurs where, you know, they add like a Boris Diaw or they add, you know, kind of a cast-off who's not quite in shape or, you know, just isn't quite in the right situation, and then it, you know, it completely clicks and they fit. You know, obviously you have to find the guy who kind of fits in the culture, but I imagine like adding a piece like that every year or two kind of you know adds a little bit of like a challenge or a little bit of a variety. Yeah. You know, like when you have that group together too much, you can, you know, get sick of each other, or you know, or there can be issues. I mean, that's obviously a difficult thing to manage because, you know, you get the wrong personality, you create a problem. But you know, they basically hit on almost every single time to do that, and obviously it's more difficult to make transactions in the 60s than it is today. You know, teams will hold on to their good players, they can hold on to them as long as they want to. The one of the crazy things is that that I had a hard time believing, one of the Celtics books that I read leading into this, there was only one trade during the Russell era the Celtics made. It was Mel Counts for Bailey Howell, which which is pretty amazing. And Albrecht was go ahead.
That's another one where like the Baltimore Bullets thought Bailey Howell was like overpriced and not worth it at that point in his career because they had Gus Johnson. I think they still had Walt Bellamy at that point. Mm-hmm. So they're like, you know, we got these other two front court players, why do we need Bailey Howell? And like Bailey Howell got traded to Boston, and without him they don't win those final two championships. So that's another example of them, like, you know, even that's their one trade, but then their one trade they still got like a veteran forward who was kind of discounted and shuffled out of the team he was on before. So really, you know, another guy who had something to prove, I guess. They had a way of finding that.
Yeah, I thought it was funny. I think it was in King of the Court where Auerbach complains that, you know, they can't do anything about draft pick because they're always picking eighth, which I given what that would be now is kind of funny. But and obviously they, you know, they hit on Havlicek. I think Havlicek was really like the last one they really landed. I mean, pretty much everyone else after that, as the team got older, it was more like, you know, the cast-offs and the, you know, those guys. They didn't have a lot of injection of really good young talent until after Russell was gone.
Yeah, I mean, hey, that speaks to Auerbach's drafting, though. Like, hell, they only had one bad year after Russell retired because they drafted JoJo White and then got Dave Cowens. So they hit on the draft picks.
I mean, you know, Auerbach as a GM, we could really, I mean, because they, in the 70s and again in the 80s, they really obviously were able to rebuild the team through the draft and through savvy trades. It's pretty remarkable. So looking at we've talked about some of them, but the main teammates that Russell played with. Well, before that, I did a search looking at everyone who played with Russell during that time, and Winshares gives Russell more credit than any other two players combined during Russell's time with the Celtics. If you you know, going by that metric, he had 163.5 win shares. The next two are Sam Jones with 92.3 and Tom Heinsohn with 60. That is obviously less than what Russell did. So that is one metric, you know, one metric that, you know, production wise shows Russell's value to the team. It just another way to illustrate that. The guys who played the most minutes with Russell were Sam Jones had by far the most with more than 24,000 minutes. Tom Heinsohn had 19,000 minutes. Satch Sanders had 18,000. John Havlicek had 17,800. Casey Jones had 17,000, and Bob Cousy had more than 16,000. And looking at, if you look at, like, on a per minute basis, Winshares for 48, his most effective teammates, I honestly, like, a lot of the older role players ended up filling that role. Bailey Howell had over a 0.204 Winshares during his time with the Celtics. Bill Sharman, one of the great shooting guards, who we really haven't talked about yet, but we'll have to talk a little bit about, at 0.184. Sam Jones right behind him at 0.182, and Don Nelson at 0.171, Frank Ramsey at 0.160, who we haven't talked about much yet. So, let's talk a little bit about some of the key players that Russell played with. Maybe we'll start with Tommy Heinsohn. He was definitely quite a character, and obviously he's been affiliated with the Celtics for, you know, more than 60 years now.
Yeah, he's been there forever. Yeah.
Yeah.
God, yeah, like this fall will be 60
yeah, right,
years.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to get the quote exactly right, but this whole story of how Russell, like, you know, told Tom Heinsohn, like, that Rookie of the Year award was really Russell's.
Yeah.
Because Russell missed, like, the first couple of months because he was playing in the Olympics. But, yeah, Tom Heinsohn, like, that first Game 7 they had against the Hawks, double overtime, 125-123, Boston wins. Tom Heinsohn, he was the hero of that game. It's like, this is one of the obscured rookie performances in NBA history. Like, people remember Magic Johnson. Like, Magic had a hell of a game, too. So I'm not trying to say, like, Magic wasn't great. But Magic had that game against the Sixers in 1980. And everybody's like, that is, like, he's just a rookie. And he put up, like, 40-12 and all that. Tom Heinsohn had 37 points and 23 rebounds against the Hawks as a rookie in that Game 7. And Russell had 19-32 as a rookie in that game. So Heinsohn was just a gunner. He came in, was getting buckets right from the get-go. God, when I wrote something about him a few years ago, like, I did a calculation of, like, shots per minute. And if I remember right, only Wilt Chamberlain, obviously, and Elgin Baylor, and I think that might have been it. I think those are the only two players who took more shots per minute than Tom Heinsohn, like, from 1957 through 1965 when he retired.
Mm-hmm.
So Tommy's role was to get in there, get some shots, get some rebounds while he was at it, but mostly just to get some shots up, score some points. He didn't play more than, I think, like 32 minutes a game in any one season. So
yeah,
his conditioning was not the best.
Yes,
to say the least.
He was a chronic smoker. Yeah, a chronic smoker, not always in the best shape, but yeah. Obviously effective when he was in there, and he was, you know, one of the early players union presidents that were, and he was the players union president when, the players took a stand during, one of the early All-Star games,
the 64 game.
Yeah. And were able to get get concessions from the commissioner to start a pension and some other things that were really key in giving the Players Association, Players Union, more strength, and eventually leading to, you know, the benefits of free agency and other things that, you know, have led to a much more successful life for athletes.
You know, now that I think about it, I'm glad you brought that up. That might go back to what we were talking about earlier, why the players are so happy to be in Boston for the most part. Like, the Celtics were the hotbed of, like, union activism in the NBA because Bob Cousy founded the Players Association. Then Heinsohn was the second president after him. And, of course, you had Russell right up in there, too, and Sat Sanders. He was no dummy either. Like, he was all up on the – he went to NYU, so he's a smart fellow there. So, like, they're all attuned to, like, kind of the labor abuses that were going on in the period. And then Boston's owner, Walter Brown, he was probably the most
progressive, maybe?
Yeah, progressive, sympathetic owner to the players' cause at that point, which is why he was kind of embarrassed in 64 because, like, that game was in Boston. So he, like, went to Heinz and was like, how dare you, like, stage the strike on my home court? Like, I've been the best person to all you guys. Like, I'm not treating you as bad as the other owners. And Heinz had to kind of apologize to him, saying, like, you know, Walter, this isn't about you. This is about the other owners who aren't being as good as you on this front. But they did have one of the best owners, like, probably the best owner when it came to player relations in that period. So that couldn't have hurt players, like, being willing to go to Boston and play as hard as they did.
Yeah, and I believe they had generally had the highest salary as well for most of the Russell's run. And Russell was generally the highest paid player in the league, or Chamberlain, depending on the situation. But
yeah, that's hard to figure out. They never accurately publicized
that, right? That so yes, I remember one of the books that I read reported that as well.
Yeah.
But either way, I mean, probably fair to say that he was on the higher end of that. I'm sure that was a pretty good motivation to go to Boston as well. So, and how about John Havlicek?
Oh, Hondo. The guy whose motor just never stopped. His final game, I'll take it completely away from the 60s. His final game in 1978, I'm not going to remember the stat line, but he scored something along the lines of like 20 points, and I think he had 8 assists. And you just watched him play. He was like 37 years old, I think, at that point. And you're looking at him, you're like, this dude can keep playing for at least 3 more years. But he decided, like, this is just time for me to quit. Like, he just can't play anymore. Or just didn't want to play anymore.
Yeah, and he was such, a really great, versatile, kind of do everything type player. Like, I kind of feel like a little bit he was a version of Scottie Pippen. As far as just kind of like the intense defense, and as far as kind of the versatility and kind of some of the same attributes, he obviously didn't have the same size, and you know, you're kind of considering different generation. But that's always kind of how I've thought of Havlicek, sort of studying him and seeing him a little bit.
Actually, this is great. Like on YouTube, I found this old video of like Reggie Jackson, the baseball player, and John Havlicek,
oh, yeah,
like doing an interview.
Yeah,
and Havlicek like was talking to him and. Reggie Jackson was just like, man, how do you always just keep running around all the time? And Havlicek told him, like, the doctors took an x-ray of his lungs one time, and they had to, have two x-ray sheets because, like, his lungs were so big. And Havlicek was like, oh, I guess that's why I have so much stamina. Like, his lungs are bigger than normal.
Yes.
Which makes complete sense. That's why he never got tired. Like, he just breathed in more oxygen and could just keep running more than other people. Which might be an unfair advantage, but, well, that's what nature gave him. So
there you go.
That explains it all.
Yeah, I believe if I recall correctly, Havlicek has a wonderful 70s fur coat on in that.
Yes, he does.
Yes, yes. So that's good times. How about Casey Jones? He was a guy that Russell studied basketball a lot with. They had a lot of conversations when they were at the University of San Francisco together, sort of bouncing ideas off each other about the game and how to play it and different things, really kind of instrumental in Russell's development in college and obviously his progression into the pros. They reunited a couple years into Russell's career.
Yeah. Russell did the Olympics, then went to the NBA. Casey Jones, I believe, went to the military for a couple of years. That's why he was delayed. If I remember right, I'm getting a little hazy. I know Sam Jones also did.
That is correct, yes.
Okay, all right, great. I was hoping I wouldn't get them confused. They both did military service then. When he did arrive, Casey was, it was good that Russell had him. Like you're talking about, like they had the camaraderie, like the connection going back to their college days. So that was kind of like Russell's, like, you know, right-hand man out there on the court defensively. And KC was a badass defender in his own right. So he would harass the point guards. And he could make the gamble when necessary, but he could funnel the player perfectly to where Russell was going to be at. So no doubt that was great to have, for Russell to have, like, you know, one of his best friends, like his, as I said, the right-hand man for him on defense out there with him. And also, he was a good replacement for Bob Cousy, too, because Cousy, when he was getting older, like, KC can come out there and, like, you know, take the tough defensive assignment when necessary, because Cousy, God bless him, just wasn't a good defender. But KC, like, provided, like, that right mix-up in the backcourt when they needed to get a defensive presence. They could throw him out there, and they could have that problem solved once he showed up in the late 50s.
Mm-hmm. How about, speaking of Cousy,
yeah.
he and Russell, they sort of, I mean, they got along fine, but there was not necessarily a particular closeness between the two until after their playing careers. And part of that is that obviously Cousy was the star, really probably the most celebrated NBA, most famous NBA player during, you know, the 50s until Russell gets there. And then, you know, Cousy still has that acclaim, that acceptance with most fans. Russell is recognized as the superstar sort of in the transition as Cousy is getting older. And, you know, Russell's value is clear. That obviously would, even after Cousy left, that would increase even more. But, you know, even though there was a little bit of natural tension maybe between the two because of the both were superstars in their own right, they didn't let that get in the way of their success as a team. And, you know, another reason why their chemistry was so strong.
Yeah. Like, and I think Russell's, I don't know, trepidation or hostility. I think that might be too strong of a word, but that was all toward kind of the perception laid upon Cousy. Like, I don't think he ever had a problem with Cousy personally. I think he kind of saw the situation that was going on, was like, you know, this is clearly some, like, you know, some racism going on, and like parochialism too, where you have the white guard from, like, Cousy went to college at Holy Cross, so went to college just outside of Boston and had been there for so long. Like, he's clearly, as you said, like the star of the NBA, the most famous basketball player when Russell joins the NBA. But Cousy won MVP in 57, but then Russell won MVP in 58. So it became quite clear quite fast that, you know, Russell was the best player on the team. But Russell could never get that acceptance from the general Boston fan or the general love that Cousy would always get. So that's something that I think he held against Cousy, obviously. Like, Russell's a really smart guy. It's like, he's not dumb enough to hold it against Cousy that people are giving him a claim and not Russell. But sure. But that's what the situation was. I think that's one of the grudges that Russell held against Boston for so long, and why maybe he wasn't as warm with Cousy as he kind of grew to be after they had retired. But they were a great combo, though. Like, these are some of the other stats I dug up on Cousy. You know, he's kind of a guy that kind of gets put down as, like, the, not in a bad way, but, like, put down as simply the guy who made great passes, flashy, who's the hardwood, the Houdini of the hardwood. But he was also a really good scorer. Didn't have a great field goal percentage. So let's go back to the context.
Yeah.
His field goal percentage was below average for the period. Like, it wasn't the worst, but it was below average for the period. But he was an excellent free throw shooter. So he would get fouled a lot, and he would drain the free throws. In fact, like, a couple of days ago was the anniversary for the game where he made 30 free throws in the playoffs. Like, he was 30 for 32 from the free throw line. So this guy would nail the free throws. And he finished first in assists 8 straight years, but also finished second in points per game 2 of those seasons. So imagine today a player that not only led the NBA in assists, but then was second in points scored in the same season.
Yeah.
So that kind of shows you the caliber of offensive production that Cousy was capable of, and passing to his teammates, but also being able to take the ball himself and score.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's he's a little bit of a hard guy to judge in the context of today's game, because obviously what guards do, what guards did then, what guards do now is incredibly different. And he, you know, was one of the real forerunners of the of being able to, you know, handle the ball and pass the ball in flashy ways. I mean, he was one of the first guys doing a lot of the fancy passes and such. So. But obviously, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, but a lot of what guards do today is, you know, it's a lineage back to Cousy. Like when you think of, you know, how Russell Westbrook obviously does it in many ways a much different way than Cousy did it, but in its essence, it's a lot of what Cousy did, where Russell Westbrook has that threat to attack the basket or pass to a teammate. Like Russell's averaging over 20 points, over 10 assists this year. Cousy was the parallel of that in his era, where like there had never been a point guard who had been able to, well, period, no point guard ever had that many assists in a game,
right?
Or average for a season, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
But also the amount of points Cousy scored, like that was unheard of for a point guard to go out there and get, you know, over 20 points a game. Very few players in the early and mid 50s were scoring 20 plus points a game, but Cousy was out there doing that in addition to getting 8 plus assists a game. So I think we kind of just relegate him to being like the marvelous, fantastic passer, which he certainly was. And he had like, we talked about Hondo's, you know, abnormally large lungs. Well, Cousy had the abnormally large eyes, which gave him like this huge peripheral vision. So there's a reason why. And also he had these huge hands. So that's why he was able to make these like behind the back passes and dribbles that other players couldn't, because he had the vision that other players didn't, but also had the huge hands to complete the moves. So he's a physical freak in his own time, and also a groundbreaker and a trailblazer in how he could score and pass the ball at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And one of kind of one of the forerunners of the modern idea of the sixth man is Frank Ramsey.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Frank. Yeah, he was actually heartbroken when Cliff Hagan got traded, because he went to Kentucky. So he and Cliff Hagan were both college teammates in Kentucky. So he was all excited that Cliff Hagan, who had been drafted by Boston, was finally going to join the Celtics in 56. But then he got traded to the St. Louis Hawks for Bill Russell. So Frank Ramsey at first was kind of bummed out about that. But then, like, when he saw that Bill Russell was who they got, like, when he realized that what they got was him, then, like, he was all on board with it. But, yes. But yeah, he was a great sixth man. He had some huge game sixes and game sevens, like a lot of these guys did. But yeah, he forerunner. Like, I can't, like, I may be wrong. I might not have done enough research, but I can't think of another player to that point who would come off the bench purely for that, you know, that specified purpose of just being out there scoring 15 to 16, 17 points and, you know, 25, 28 minutes. And that's all you're asked to do. But. Yeah. He also, unfortunately, was the forerunner. Well, not forerunner. He was just one of the best at it. He was a flopper, Frank Ramsey.
That's right.
He was a pretty good defender, but also would flop whenever the moment suited him. So he's probably the godfather of flopping in the NBA. So right. Anderson Varejão and Vlade Divac, they owe him royalty checks.
They do. Yeah, there's a pretty infamous Sports Illustrated article from like 62-ish where he basically like gives like all the tricks of the trade in flopping, which he definitely kind of embarrassed the league and led to some changes in how fouls were called against him toward the end of his career. But yeah, he was definitely an important, definitely, you know, a little bit down the list of guys who were important to the team, but definitely was, you know, he was, you know, I believe five or six of those championships that belonged to him. So was, you know, really important player in those early Celtics teams. And I think we'll close with Bill Sharman, one of the we've talked a little bit about Bill before, but really a forerunner in terms of conditioning and just the ability to shoot effectively both from the field and from the line. He had a really high shooting percentage for his time, sort of understood, you know, the value of taking good shots, and just was a guy who just ran around the court tirelessly looking for an open shot and made a lot of them.
Yeah, and this is a guy I neglected to mention earlier, who was another great defender that they had on the perimeter. So, like, in the pre-Russell Celtics, Bill Sharman was probably their best defensive player, which, unfortunately, when you have Bob Cousy and Ed McCauley as your other big players, neither one of them could play a lick of defense. That's a problem. But Bill, great defender, as you were talking already, great shooter, one of the first players to shoot 90% from the free throw line. Yeah, his career free throw percentage is 88%, so – that's an ice cooler right there. End of the game, get the ball to Bill Sharman. They foul him, he's nailing all the free throws. That's something I should have mentioned earlier, too, with their offense. Like, they had some pretty good free throw shooters on their team, too, so that would help kind of make up for the poor field goal percentage.
Yeah.
But yeah, Charmin, getting back to him, like, great shooter, great free throw shooting. Also, one of the standout teammates in the NBA. This is like the pre-Celtics when he played with the Washington Capitals, but it's still a good story to relate. Kind of shows you how his attitude was. Was when Earl Lloyd, who was like he was the first black player to play in an NBA game. He and Earl Lloyd were on the Washington Capitals, and they would have practice here in D.C. Well, I'm in D.C., so like here in D.C., they would have practice here. And this is like 1950, so it's still segregation era. And Bill Sharman would give Earl Lloyd a ride every day from the same spot to their practice facility and then give him a ride home afterwards. So talking about this white player driving a black guy through a segregated city together to practice, then would drive the dude home. So I think that says a lot about Bill Sharman. Like, he was the guy that was out there looking out for his teammates, wasn't trying to judge nobody on all this other crap that they didn't need to be judged on. And so I stand up dude. And then when he became a coach, always held his players accountable, had those great conditioning ideas. He would try to tell his teammates about it in Boston when he was a player. Some of them, like Tom Heinsohn, really didn't listen to him, but he was always out there to give them tips, always did his running regimen. It's a great story how his wife would, like, drive the car right behind him as he would run up and down the neighborhood. But, yeah, fitness nut, great teammate, great defender, great shooter. I absolutely love Bill Sharman. Was a great dude up until the end of his life. Really fantastic person.
Yeah, based on everything I've read about him, I'd definitely get the same vibe. Like, imagining, there's some descriptions of kind of the way that he played. I sort of just in my head imagine a little bit of like a Ray Allen style of just running around the court and, you know, fighting through the screen or, you know, getting the screens, his defender trying to fight through those screens and just getting that open shot. Obviously, without a three-pointer, it looks very different, but it's still, you know, it's still basketball. It's still a lot of the same philosophies. They're still looking for open shots even then, so.
Yeah, and you say fighting through the screens, he would literally fight people, too. He was probably the biggest fighter.
That's right.
Great teammate, but also he got a lot of fisticuffs. But it was all on the court. He would not fight anybody off the court.
Yeah.
Sweetheart off the court.
So, looking at before we close, I just want to look at sort of the which Celtics team was the best of the 11 champions, and I'll look at the numbers first, and then we, you know, if we feel like there's a different team that we should choose, then we can definitely talk about that. But looking at the numbers, it's sort of a toss up between 60 and 62. In 60, they led all the that was the highest year they had in win percentage. They were the second best SRS and a ridiculous a plus 8.5 defensive rating over the league average. In 62, they led they had the best of the best SRS of any of those teams. They were third in win percentage. Also, the 63 team was the most dominant defensive team compared with the rest of the league, but also the worst offense of the Celtics dynasty. The 65 team, on the other hand, had the best offense, but the second worst defense, although still clearly ahead of the league. And 65 was probably like the last year they were really like a dominant regular season team compared to the rest of the league. After that, the Sixers kind of rose up and exceeded them for a couple of years, even though it was back and forth in the playoffs.
Yeah, I've thought about this question a lot, and I hate to dodge the question, but I'm gonna have to dodge the question. I never can't pick a good, or I can't pick the best like Celtics team.
Yeah.
I can kind of eliminate the ones that aren't the best. I think like the 68 and 69 teams, I think we can safely like exclude them as among the best ones. They still got the championship, obviously, but I don't think those were the best teams they fielded. But yeah, I really can't pick. Like, if you force me, I would say the 62 team, only because they apparently, in my mind, they had the hardest road in capturing the championship. So if they beat the two hardest teams I think they ever faced that postseason and got the championship, then I think overall they were probably the best Celtics team that they put forward. But maybe another year they didn't have a hard time because they had the best team. They just swept everybody out the playoffs. I don't know. But if I had to choose, I guess I would go with 62.
Yeah. I was going to go with 63. That's the first year for Havlicek. And Cousy's still on the team. Heinsohn's still on the team. They're kind of getting toward the end of the road. you know, Russell's 28, Sam Jones is 29. So they're obviously older, but they're not quite old yet. You know, they still kind of have enough youth on their side, the kind of the mix of veteran savvy. And I think they have maybe 10 Hall of Famers on that team. I believe there's 10 Hall of Famers on that team, which
We got Bill Russell, Sam Jones, Havlicek.
Yeah. Zach Sanders in the Hall of Fame, right?
Sanders, he is in the Hall of Fame, not as a player, but as a contributor.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Okay.
Heinsohn, Kuzi.
KC's in
there. Frank Ramsey, Clyde Lavellet.
Yeah.
That's 9.
Okay. 9. That's right. Okay. Yeah.
Only 9 Hall of Famers.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So not too bad. Honestly, any of those teams, there's a lot of Hall of Famers on all those teams. So you can maybe even pick a different one to, as far as that goes. But yeah, I would say I just kind of feel like you want to have Havlicek on that team if you want to kind of pick the best. Even though he's obviously a rookie there and not at the peak of his powers, but. That would be my thought.
I'm looking at the 63 squad. That's a hell of a team. Yeah. I'm gonna have to go with them.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they didn't perform the best of all of the Celtics teams, but if like you had to, if you say, okay, you have to pick one of the teams to face off in this great basketball battle, then that would probably be the one that would pick.
Yeah, man. But then, you know, I'm probably looking at like the 57 squad in 5 minutes, and I probably think they're the best one. And then the 66 team in like 3 minutes after that, I'll think that's the best one.
Yeah.
That's the trouble with 11 championship teams, man. It's
right. Yeah. Amazing stuff. So is there anything else that we should bring up before we go?
One little curious little thing. This is real quick.
Sure.
Little thing I found, or I did research on, I was just curious as to how long did it take for Boston to lose 10 games every season?
Ooh.
Because I would read these books and it's like the Celtics always get up to a hot start and then like they build a huge lead and they just kind of coast the rest of the year. And it kind of pans out. Like the worst start they ever had was a 17-10 start, and that was in 1957, their first championship year.
Mm-hmm. And they obviously didn't have Russell yet, so.
Yeah, Russell was missing for a lot of most of those games. I'm just going to run through it real fast. Like 57 was 17-10, so this is just going year after year.
Sure.
So 17-10, then 26, 26-10, 23-10, 32-10, 23-10, 38-10, 24-10, 32-10, 46-10. So maybe that 1965 squad is the best one.
Yeah, that's a good one, too.
46-10.
Yeah, that's
Then 24-10, 28-10, 25-10, 20-10. So you kind of see how they kind of start sliding back at the end of it. But
yeah.
But yeah, that it was true. They kind of blew out to see these huge record leads, and they just kind of were able to coast to the finish line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, up until the last couple of years there where they you got older and slower, they still they saw those fast starts all those years. So, yeah, they were good.
Yep.
That's our conclusion. The Celtics were good.
So to summarize, yes, they were really good.
Well, Curtis, thanks so much for joining the show. We always appreciate it. It's always a pleasure. Always learn something. So thanks so much. Is there anything that you want to specifically let our listeners know about?
Two things. Number one, I guess by the time this gets posted, like this already have happened, but I got a really good article. I haven't written it yet, but I assume it's going to be great once I write it. It's going to be about Wilt Chamberlain and the time he scored 0 points in a game.
Ooh.
Yeah. It's like it was the second to last game of his career in the regular season. So it's going to be a really good avenue to kind of talk about how his game changed as he got older. But there's a game where he took 0 shots, scored 0 points. And then also, I got admitted to a PhD history program. So I'd be, like, official, like, doctor in history, like, in 5 years.
That's
so
awesome. Yeah.
Officially Dr. Pro Hoops History.
Yeah. There you go. I'll have to market that one. You know, make sure you get the trademarks so no one else can take that. So Dr. Pro Hoops History, yes.
Yep. No one else can claim it. So, yep, that's my stuff out there.
Awesome. Well, that's great as always. And, So yeah, Rich and I are each getting married, not to each other, but we're both getting married in the first
That's
week of April.
Now, so this is good.
So, what's that?
I said it's legal now, though.
It is. It's true. It's true. So, so we'll have shows during that time, but we will not be around for that time. But we'll be back. Hopefully, there will not be more than a week of interruption in shows as we move through that. So. That's exciting in our lives. So,
yeah, well, congratulations.
Thank you very much. Excited, of course. So, thanks everyone for checking us out. You can find us at HarvardParoxysm.com. We are on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back NBA. You can find Over and Back on iTunes and Stitcher. If you want to leave us a rating or review, that would be awesome. We prefer a good one, but you know, be honest. We don't want you to lie to yourselves. So until next time, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon.